Hi, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
William Mazzarella.
Great to have you with us. Thanks so much for coming into the pod. Right now, the podcat is sleeping. It's his invisible hour, which is roughly 1 till 6 normally here in Madrid. Should he emerge, he may try to intervene into our conversation, but that's what podcats do. So, my first question is to ask what's currently interesting, preoccupying, retarding, dynamizing you? What's happening right now?
I'm trying to write a paper at the moment, which goes back to some of my very earliest concerns, and yet at the same time somehow pushes into new speculative territory. I think the question that I'm starting from is it's very common to hear people describe advertising as a kind of magic. And I'm basically saying, what would happen if we didn't treat it as a simile, but in fact took it entirely literally and said advertising is magic? What kind of resources do we have for thinking that proposition? And I'm doing that in the context of some research that I've been doing for a very long time, which actually goes back to my dissertation fieldwork more than 25 years ago at this point. And it has to do with a man who was, one of the biggest, most charismatic, most flamboyant kind of stars of the Bombay advertising scene in the 60s and 70s, who founded an advertising agency in 1965 that rapidly rose to being at the very peak of the business within just a few years, and then spectacularly crashed and burned. And folded up by 1975. So it was a 10-year period of boom and bust, very dramatic, very spectacular. The agency is still remembered by those in the business as maybe the most flamboyant, the most spectacular of the kind of creative boom of the Indian advertising business in the 60s. And the man who founded it and who ran it, a man called Kersi Katrak, I subsequently discovered, after having met him only once during my fieldwork, he then later died in 2007. I subsequently discovered that not only was he this flamboyant ad man, this charismatic figure, but he was also a published poet in English. I went on to edit a collection of his poetry, and a very keen occultist. So in this juxtaposition in his life, you have these several magics going on, both overlapping and sometimes kept apart. So you have the magic of mass publicity, as it were. You have the magic of the poetics, and you have the magic of magic, of the occult, of these esoteric traditions that he was interested in. So I've been trying to kind of dig through these different layers of his life and times, his story, and that period also in Indian kind of public life, to make sense of this question. How could we think of advertising as magic? What would that mean? And for me, it's an extension, I guess, of a sort of question that I've been preoccupied with since the beginning, which is I've treated it in, using different kinds of language at different times. But really the question is, like, what makes something resonate? Why do things resonate or not? Why do some things kind of burst into life, energy, fascination, and others don't, and it's clearly not just a question of meaning, but it's also a question of, in some sense, meaning that comes to matter in some way. So yeah, I mean, also the reason I mean, there are a couple of agendas going on there. One is to kind of think about let's say, enchantment in what would appear to be on the surface one of the most kind of disenchanted spheres of contemporary life, commerce, but also politics and sort of thinking questions of charisma, like what are we even talking about when we talk about charisma? And the other one is to, as an anthropologist, I occupy a discipline which has made a very curious kind of deal or settlement with the question of enchantment, which is that I think from the beginning, anthropology as a discipline said, we're going to take enchantment seriously, we're going to take magic seriously, we're going to give them the dignity of alternative worldviews. But precisely as long as they are alternative, as long as they belong to someone else, right? So there's a kind of funny way in which to just be a bit technical for a moment. I sometimes think of the discipline of anthropology itself as a kind of symptom of the historical sublation of magic, that is the kind of simultaneous, preservation and supersession of magic. So I'm trying to work my way back through that as well. And in doing that, again, it seems important to point to the magic at the very heart of what seems to be the most kind of disenchanted domains of kind of contemporary life.
And here, I guess, one of the people you invoke a fair bit is Emil Durkheim, and in particular, his notion of there being this impulse that can drive people towards certain activities or emotional investments, let's say. But I guess whenever the word disenchantment is used, I think about Max Weber and Weber's notion that modernity, through its bureaucratic norms, was overdetermining the possibilities of magic, or it's being shunted off to one side. And some people have taken that to have been a prediction of a greater secularism around the world, which appears not to have happened. So I wonder if you could, at this point, just jump in and help us see what religion is and what magic is, and whether they intersect at all or do not.
This is one of those impossible questions, Toby, but I will say that for Durkheim, Durkheim made a very clear distinction in the elementary forms of religious life, where he said, that magic is instrumental activity and religion has to do with morality, with moral categories. It's a kind of end in itself, as it were, whereas magic is always about some other end. And that's one of the distinctions in a way that I'm trying to trouble. Part of what interests me in the history of what we might call magic, and here I'm thinking with, traditions like Neoplatonism. I'm thinking with, Renaissance magic, Renaissance Neoplatonists. Part of what interests me in that is that it becomes actually quite difficult to disentangle magic from religion. And part of what preoccupied people like Giordano Bruno in the 16th century was, constantly having to claim that what they were doing was in fact morally okay. And of course he ended up on the wrong side of that and was burned at the stake in 1600 in Rome. So part of my investment here is actually calling into question that distinction. And of course there's a long history within institutionalized religion of both absorbing and disavowing magical traditions. So, I mean, the Catholic sacraments, some have argued, are essentially kind of appropriated alchemical stages, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when it comes to Weber and the discourse of modernity as disenchantment, I touched on the category that is sort of the exception to that already in Weber, which is charisma. Right. So charisma is, as it were, the thing that kind of, the exception to the rule, but also in a way the structural fault line of modernity for Weber. So if disenchantment brings about a kind of, sort of waning of affect and a kind of routinization and a bureaucratization of everything, charisma is the thing that kind of bursts out of that machine and sort of re-energizes, revitalizes in an amoral way, actually, the entire project of, of modern life. So, of course, Weber's theory can be read as a sort of recipe for a revolutionary process, but also can be read as a kind of presentiment of the Third Reich.
Well, he was in his three types of authority, I think not suggesting that charismatic authority would disappear completely. And speaking of that, brings me to your writings on you know who, DJ Trump, and your provocation that putting aside all the other things people might say or have said about him, for many people, he is charismatic. And that's always interested me because when I've been in the presence of extremely famous people, I have sensed that there is something almost visual about them that almost emanates from them. And this is experienced by people around them. I was in a crowd in the days after September 11th, 2001, in downtown New York, where I was living, when Bill Clinton walked down the University Place, and there were thousands of young NYU students who'd just arrived and who'd been told, whose parents had been told they'll be completely safe, don't worry. And they, like me, were reaching out to Clinton. And, he touched our hands and he cried. And a couple of these young women, must have been 17, looked at one another and wept and said, "He's got such soft hands." And that was a moment when I felt as I was in the presence of charisma. And obviously, people feel that way about Barack Obama also. Conversely, I've never been close to DJ Trump, but when I see him or hear him speak, I just hear thought disorder and idiocy. And so it's puzzling to me that because Clinton and Obama could match their physical appeal in some sense with a rhetorical majesty and a grasp of issues, right? Whereas it seems to me that Donald Trump doesn't have that, except at some level he does, because he keeps thumping on about the one or two things that matter to his base. So I wonder if within this notion of charisma and how you see Trump as having it, whether there are different kinds of charisma. One where it's just, one or two issues and a certain look and a regime of publicity, and another where there is something substantive as well as, say, physical beauty in the case of Clinton or Obama.
I like this thing about Clinton crying, right? Crying as a power move. It's a very, very interesting phenomenon. He's got such soft hands. I mean, there's a lot of erotics to that, right? I mean, there's a kind of there's a real, you said physical beauty as well. I mean, part of my reaction to your question is that, some of it's perspectival, right? Like one person's experience of charisma is another person's experience of disgust or revulsion, right? And that's also, the maybe it's like two faces of the same energy in a way, right? That part of my thinking about Trump is that it's actually quite important to his charisma that many of us find him appalling and disgusting. Right. And that actually feeds his charisma to those people who admire him and identify with him or experience him as, fascinating in a positive way. I think many of us find him fascinating whether we want to or not. I mean, that would be my argument, that there's a kind of car crash quality to Trump as well that is hard to look away from, even if you find him absolutely repulsive. I often refer back to my own experience during the 2015 Republican candidate debates in the lead up to the election, the first time where I certainly had the feeling that, of kind of being compelled to watch this thing unfold, because it was just, I mean, I was repelled, but I was also fascinated. I can't deny it. There was something about Trump's capacity to completely ignore the conventions, of statesmanship, and to do so compellingly. There's one version of that where you just experience the person as fading away because they are unable to occupy the space in any way. Whereas Trump was able to kind of fill that space in a way that was perplexing, appalling, fascinating, etc. And so, the kind of position that I've taken on this in writing about it has been that there is, what Lacanian psychoanalysis calls like a jouissance around Trump. There's a kind of enjoyment of Trump that has nothing to do actually with cost benefit or pleasure pain or any kind of utilitarian, calculus, but rather a kind of, a kind of enjoyment that one finds oneself in, irrespective of one's like actual judgment of Trump. Having said that, I mean, I do think that there is a reason to, there might be a reason to make an argument about different modalities of charisma. I think we have kind of beautiful charisma, we have sublime charisma, we have terrifying charisma, we have, kind of, again, coming back to psychoanalysis, people have made the argument that, there's kind of like super ego based charisma, there's ego based charisma, there's like id based charisma. There's all of these have different kind of implications for the sort of relationship that one feels or imagines in relation to charisma. But I mean, I think where you started, around this question of what is the experience of being in the room with or being in the same space as someone who is either extremely famous or for some other reason has this effect, is that you feel it as a kind of thickening of the air. There's a kind of sense of all attention being drawn in one direction, and it becomes hard to say, where it's coming from. Is it in them? Is it in you? Is it a relation? Is it something that's somehow situationally manifesting? Hard to say. I mean, we have the habit of presuming that somehow charisma is a property of the individual that we call charisma. And, this kind of theological background to that as well. I mean, the word charisma originates, well, actually doesn't originate, but is formalized as an element of Christian theology, where it refers basically to divine gifts. But actually, I think people have thought about magic, for instance, the power of the magician, have made some useful interventions here, suggesting that, actually something like a magical capacity or a charismatic capacity depends on those of us around the charismatic person. We have to, in some way, be awakened into it. We have to sort of give our attention, our libido, our fascination to this, whether consciously or not, whether deliberately or not. But, I do think it's relational when it comes down to it. The question is just like, why does it arise when it arises? There's an interesting, I mean, it's in some ways it's kind of enigmatic. You know when it's there and you know when it's not there. And it's very hard to do anything about it either way,
It's the Miller case before the Supreme Court about pornography in 1973. You know what it is when you see it.
Yeah, but you can't define it.
It's hard to predict and it's hard to put into words. And it's very difficult to define in legal terms because of the fact that it relates so clearly to bodily responses that the person who is schooled in how to respond to the naked figure in art, in a museum, or in an art school, right, will be able to deal with their physical responses, it is thought, in ways that the person who is not so schooled, when confronted with nudity, will be unrestrained. And this is one of the ways in which, going back to the debates about Lady Chatterley, a distinction was drawn about what is erotics versus what is pornography and what is art. It was about the ability to control yourself publicly and privately. So I think that that's absolutely right. And this also suggests that some of this is about occasions, right? That it may not be a permanent quality of people, and it may be occasions
And yeah,
of factors.
and forms of sublimation, right? Like, you know, what you were saying about, you know, why do we think there's a difference between someone who's educated in aesthetic appreciation and someone who comes across like a nude without preparation or without the, you know, quote unquote proper apparatus of aesthetic judgment. You know, we could make maybe that same argument about the political field. And that, you know, maybe some of the kind of anxiety around a figure like Trump is that people are having a kind of visceral reaction, who are thought to be unsophisticated, who are thought to be, as it were, either deliberately or not, refusing or ill-equipped or lacking the proper apparatus of citizenship, right? The proper kind of capacities for discernment and judgment and reason and sublimation and so forth.
It all comes back to Durkheim's nephew.
It does. Moss will sooner or later rear his head.
He crawls back in with descriptions of forms of swimming that no one can now understand.
Right. Even recognize as swimming.
Picking up on what I just dropped in there, pornography and so on, one of your books that I very much appreciate, although it touches on lots of things about which I don't know very much, is to do with cinema and censorship and publicity. And this is censorium. And I wondered, given that we were just talking about correct bodily responses to phenomena, whether you could take us into this book a wee bit. I know it's from many years ago, and sometimes one can't always be held to judgment on one's published past. But,
Or indeed remember it. Yeah.
well, you know, you're allowed to reach back behind you, William, and see if you can find a copy and look at the index and say, what proper names keep recurring? Oh, I remember her.
Yeah. That book was an attempt. Well, let me put it this way. On the surface, it was a study of different phases in cinema censorship and the regulation of the cinema in India. And it involved a comparison between the colonial period, when cinema censorship was first introduced in India around 1920, and various debates around that time, with then a later stage in the 1990s, which was kind of during the kind of post-liberalization period in India, where there was an influx of a lot of foreign goods, and there was also a kind of pressure on what could be shown or done in Indian cinema, and there was a lot of anxiety about cultural imperialism and about kind of new forms of obscenity or sexual provocation, et cetera, et cetera. So that was the surface level of what that book was about, in a sense, the kind of the object at a surface level. But actually, what I was interested in a way, was the question of how any polity depends on what you could call the incitement and containment of affective energies. And so, whereas it's quite conventional when you're talking about censorship to treat it only as a question of silencing or control, I was quite interested in thinking instead about censorship as this kind of like two-step game of sort of the incitement of collective energies and the attempt then to harness them in particular ways to particular kinds of social and political projects. And that's why, in the course of doing that project, I came up with this term, cumbersome term, terribly cumbersome term, performative dispensation. But it was designed to be a way of talking about how every polity, every kind of sovereign claim to authority involves both the provocation, literally the calling forth, provocation, and the kind of routinization of collective energies. And in that way too, it was a kind of extension of kind of the Durkheimian ritual problematic of, you know, collective effervescence and the management of collective effervescence through symbolic forms and social institutions. But yeah, I mean, you know, part of what came up in the course of that project was this whole question of obscenity. Because of course, obscenity is very often at stake in these kind of controversies over films and books and plays and so forth.
My recollection was that the colonial administration was very worried about depictions of fallen women, of white
Yes.
women being depicted as sexually available or not competent or in some way public, in ways
Yeah,
that did not
absolutely.
suit the image of the British colonial woman that was the preferred stereotype. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things that happened in India, especially after 1857, 58, when there was a rebellion, a big rebellion, as most people know, against British colonial authority, was that the policing of racial boundaries became much more of a both spatially observed in the sense that the lines between white and non-white living were much more tightly drawn, but also on the stage in literature, and then starting in the 1890s in the cinema, there was a lot of anxiety about the ways in which white female bodies could appear to brown spectators, and the kind of implications of white female bodies being rendered public and sexualized at a time when, you know, colonial authority in many ways depended on the insistence on an insistence on the kind of transcendence of sort of white untouchability in some way.
In addition to writing about topics like magic that get less attention than they used to, you are also prepared to dive in and use terms that allegedly no longer apply. But I very much agree with the fact you keep using them. And the particular one I've got in mind is mass society, which lots of people associate A with either Dwight MacDonald or the Frankfurt School people looking at media. Or, and they apply it to the period up until the late 1990s, when it is claimed that as a consequence of the availability of the internet and the creating of one's own meanings, the concept no longer applies. So this is not an attack on your use of it at all, but I'm wondering about your choice of it and what it means to you in the light of the fact that it's having to brush away some cobwebs for some readers in order to be a concept of today.
Yeah, cobwebs. It's interesting. I think you're right to suggest that one thing that's happened since the late 1990s and the rise of kind of like, you know, internet marketing and narrow casting and algorithms and all the rest of it, is somehow the idea that we now live in a world where we're moving increasingly towards a kind of total isomorphism between who we are and the messages that address us in a very customized way. I guess I cling to the idea not only that for some romantic reason, you know, that that's never going to be possible, but also that in some way it rests on a kind of philosophical mistake or misunderstanding. Because if you assume that we are constituted through our encounter with the images that address us, but you also assume that desire is only possible if there's something that exceeds, as it were, something that exceeds the thing that is like immediately presented to you, that there's a kind of deferral or a space beyond, then the idea that we could ever reach a situation where there's a one-to-one correspondence between who I understand myself to be and the messages that address me is, I think, problematic. The other side of that is that, as you know from having read my stuff, I continue to have a kind of investment in some of the theorists who were kind of part of the theorization of the critical theorization of mass media and mass society in the first half of the 20th century. And I speak especially of the kind of conversation between Theodor Adorno and Walter Benjamin. And the reason why I remain interested in them is not because I think they necessarily had the right answers, but because I think they were asking the right questions and were asking them in ways that are still pertinent today, and were asking them with a kind of multimodal sophistication that that I think is often lacking today. For instance, and coming back to magic, I think Walter Benjamin is interesting in part because he was thinking, as it were, a kind of very modernist set of propositions about what was happening with mass media, with cinema, with mass publics, together with a whole series of esoteric and even occult kind of discourses around resonance, around occult correspondence, around graphology, around kind of the origins of language. So that for me remains a kind of inspiration. Also because I think one of the implications of Benjamin's work, which he himself I think was very ambivalent about, was the difficulty of drawing clear distinctions between what counts as progressive and reactionary ideas. You have Benjamin drawing on like real reactionary figures in the intellectual environment of his time, like Ludwig Klages or Stefan George. These are people who are like by no means progressives, but there's something that Benjamin recognizes in the work that they're doing that even if he disagrees with their politics, he notices that they're attending to something that maybe like the liberal thinkers or even the leftist thinkers of his time are not able to conceptualize for whatever reason. So there's a very interesting kind of political ambiguity also in those traditions of thinking, which continue to me to be inspirational in trying to make sense of something like the Trump phenomenon. And all these sort of questions of resonance, of magic, of enjoyment feel like they have more traction, or they like people in ostensibly reactionary traditions of thought have maybe thought harder about some of those things, even if the conclusions that they drew from that were in many cases abhorrent, at a political or a kind of moral level,
Well,
you
if you
know.
think about the Brexit campaign of 2016, same year as the role of evangelicals in destroying the peace vote in the Colombian plebiscite, same year, of course, as Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton. One of the resonant moments was when Michael Gove, a Scottish politician, very influential former journalist and so-called intellectual, one of the great moments of that was when he derided what he called experts, as if experts know things. We've had enough of experts telling us that leaving the European Union will be a disaster. And as soon as I heard this, I thought, what about the expert who fixes your sore tooth? Or the expert who fixes your ingrowing toenail? Are you not interested in them? And are you not interested in experts who can tell you what different languages mean? Oh, gee, what a fool am I? But it clearly resonated with a lot of people. It was a denunciation of what had been a mobilization of rationality contra the interests of large parts of the white English working class. Absolutely no question, it seems to me. Okay. So, and similarly with the appeal of some of this sort of denunciation of rationality as being associated with a class of person who have controlled your life, in inverted commas, and should not be allowed to do so anymore. And forgetting that is a problem. Now, this brings me back to your earlier remark that I thought was very apposite about how the apparent cultural relativism of anthropology, they can have their magic, we'll even study it, it's interesting. If we're interested in structural anthropology, we'll even say that it's homologous to what scientists and medical professionals do, right? And we'll say that science and magic are using the same parts of the brain to try to solve the same problems, albeit in different ways. But that ultimately, this is a sort of shell game by anthropology. And your essay on populism, that's in the annual review of anthropology, a very esteemed journal, a place where people like me, who are dilettantes, go to find out what the current thinking is on topics X, Y, and Q, right? There, you're very critical, I think, of the way in which liberal ideas obfuscate the ability to understand populism. So I wonder if you could help us out here, if I've understood you correctly, or if not, in thinking about the connection between liberalism and populism and the question of knowledge or expertise.
Let me try to address the liberalism and populism question as I understand it. Liberal critics of populism will often attack it on a couple of fronts. One front is that they will liken it to faith. That is, they will associate it with a kind of irrationality that they associate with religion or with faith, and which they imagine as being contrary to reason or rational argument. So that's one front. There's a kind of analogization of populism by liberals to religious faith, and through that to unreason, as kind of the opposite of critical reason and kind of appropriate forms of public debate. The other one, which interests me a great deal, is the suspicion of the body in liberalism and the suspicion of the capacities and forces of visceral attachments. So part of the problem with populist figures, populist authoritarian figures, but not only, part of the problem with any kind of like populist claim, I think, for liberals, and I'm using the term liberal here in the kind of very classical sense of liberal, is that it represents a kind of recrudescence of the visceral in the political space. And that suspicion of the visceral, that suspicion of the body, of bodily capacities and bodily responses, I think often goes hand in hand with this kind of prejudicial equation between populism and kind of religious faith. So there's a kind of, one could almost caricature it as a kind of Protestant critique of a sort of Catholic tendency, toward magic and toward kind of manifestation, physical embodiment, transubstantiation in the political space, where the people, you're no longer just representing the people, you're actually physically, literally bringing the people into presence, in the populist modality. And that's something that I think liberals have a great deal of trouble with because, as Claude Lefort so famously put it, in a democracy, the place of power is empty, is an empty place. It's illegitimate in the kind of liberal democratic imaginary to embody the place of power. And that immediately throws us from a liberal perspective back onto, divine kingship and sort of pre-democratic forms of authority, political theology, etc., etc. So that's kind of where, where I see the provocation to liberal thought coming in populism. Now, what to do with that then is like, is there a way of thinking about, in a way, the visceral dimension of the political that isn't either a kind of liberal dismissal of the visceral altogether, or necessarily, some kind of like affirmative celebration of like the energies of the multitude or something like that. Is there some way in which we can kind of be a little bit more agnostic, maybe about what's going on in that space, without having either to kind of celebrate it or sort of abject it? I think that's kind of where my investments lie, maybe.
I like the idea of saying we should be a little more agnostic when we talk about magic and religion. So, Prof. W, I've got two more questions for you, if I may, after which I'd like to hand over to you to add anything you may wish to what we have discussed thematically or something we haven't mentioned. Does that sound all right as a way of concluding? So, my first question is a rather banal one, and imagine this is the University of Chicago, a team of biologists, ethnobotanists, and chemists deciding whether to give you some ultimate University of Chicago award. But they want to know how you do things, how you know things. What's your answer?
As a social science, and in the United States, anthropology is generally considered to be a social science. We are a little bit eccentric. A lot of our sister social sciences will insist on things like samples and being able to make a claim that what you're saying is in some sense representative or statistically valid or something like that. I've tended to stress, in a way, a very different kind of knowing. And I take some inspiration, I think, from literary claims. That is, you sometimes hear a novelist, for instance, saying that the more specific I made my character, the more general was their appeal. And I think, in some ways, there's a lesson in that also for those of us who are doing empirical or kind of social scientific work, that it's not just that, as Max Horkheimer, I think, once said, for the understanding, one concentration camp is enough. It's also that, that there is a way in which if you can make something very, very specific, if you can really participate in it imaginatively, viscerally, and get it down in a way that makes it come alive in its irreducible specificity. The paradoxical thing that often happens then, more actually than if you try to genericize it, is that it kind of comes to embody some sort of like general or even universal truth. And so that's how I would say I know things, is through the act of trying to hone the particularity of the thing I'm thinking about, which always then in some way like suggests to me something general, something of general significance. It's paradoxical, but I think it works. It's a kind of alchemical trick that that I think that we have something to learn from literature there.
And Prof, my last question for you is, I'm 25. I mean, I'm actually 65, but for the purposes of our discussion, although the Spanish state just declared that I'm 45. So
All right, good. Nice.
as cricketers and footballers tell us, age is just a number, to which one says, yes, of course it is. And that's the damn point. But in any event, I'm 25. I've arrived in the United States to commence doctoral studies in anthropology. And I'm knocking on your door to say, Prof, I've read your work. I like it. I'm confused because I've arrived here and there's this thing called the four fields and they're foreign to me. What are they? And do I need to know them all in order to do my doctorate on religion, for example, in order to become an anthropologist?
Well, I think the first thing I would say to anyone who's embarking on a PhD in anthropology is like, are you sure you know what you're doing? If you are, though, I think there's some very interesting places that we can go. But I think that that's something that anyone should, no one should do that unless there's absolutely nothing they want to do more. So that would be my first piece of advice, or my first caution, or my first kind of diagnostic intervention. As for the four fields, I'm in a department which, we have a very strong and well-known linguistic anthropology tradition. We have an archaeology tradition that is unusually integrated with our sociocultural anthropology. Whereas in a lot of American and I dare say British anthropology departments, archaeology and social or cultural anthropology hardly know how to talk to each other. We barely have biological anthropology, so I can't say much about that. I think it really depends on the kind of question that you're trying to answer. I think there are creative ways in which to engage a four-field problematic. But very often there's also a kind of defensive conservativeness around the boundaries of these domains, especially when it comes to the relationship between sociocultural on the one hand and archaeology or biological anthropology on the other. So it really depends who you have in the room and what the question that you're asking is.
Well said, sir.
I'm all in favor of, productive derailment. I think it's good to, go down rabbit holes that are not necessarily the ones that you expected to travel down. But there also has to be some kind of, basic shared ontological terrain for that to generate anything useful, I think.
So to conclude, I'm wondering if there are things you'd like to add to the topics we've touched on or different areas.
I think my own experience has been that one moves very often from, as a young person, being ambitious and clever to, as an older person, maybe feeling that if it doesn't have existential significance, then what's the point? And I think, part of my interest in the question of magic is also the question of, not only, not so much the question of, when people talk about advertising, it's very much often like, oh, well, advertising, does it manipulate people? Is it a kind of magic that causes us to want things that we shouldn't want, et cetera, et cetera? But I've become more and more interested in the question of like, what happens to the magician? What are the existential costs and affordances of getting absorbed in those kinds of wagers on what the world might yield. So that would be my thoughts about academic work as well. Like when you start out, you're taught to make, clever arguments and to fortify your positions and all of that. And that very easily ends up in a kind of alienated position where you're essentially treating it as a series of chess moves. But my question then would be like, why are you doing it? What's not in the sense of like, are you doing something interesting in the world? Are you doing something worthwhile? But rather like, why existentially, personally, are you involved in these questions? And what is that doing to you? So yeah, that would be the thought that I would I would leave us with at this point.
I think that's very valuable. Thank you so much, William. It was really wonderful having the chance to chat to you.
Thanks, Toby.